This is a 2020 Thanksgiving, a special production from The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about our favorite Thanksgiving traditions and some of the things that will be different this year.
My family is made up of a bunch of nerds, and in 2001, we decided right after Thanksgiving dinner that we could no longer wait and would all go pile up into the cars and drive to the theater to go see the first Harry Potter movie. Ever since, even though there are now more years than Harry Potter movies that have transpired since 2001, we still go to the movies each year. So I'll definitely be missing that in my family this year, but maybe we'll watch a Netflix party or something.
The thing I miss most about Thanksgiving this year is sitting around the kitchen island and drinking wine with my sisters, and especially the chocolate pecan pie that my sister makes.
Speaking of food, this holiday is made for overindulgence. Twice the turkey we could possibly eat.
Two turkeys.
My mother insists on bringing additional turkey.
Turkey, like, piled high.
And should that somehow not be enough meat?
Ham.
More side dishes than the table can hold.
Two different stuffings.
Mashed potatoes. Always fried rice. Always regular rice. Always brown rice.
Green beans, mac and cheese, and of course,
7 different pies.
And even if things look different this year, chances are you'll still eat a huge meal, which means your digestive system will work overtime. The moment you start smelling the food, it's kicking into gear.
It is. That turkey in the oven you're smelling is just playing with your emotions and playing with your digestive system. That's where we start to increase saliva production.
That's Atlanta gastroenterologist Earl Campbell III. I asked Earl to break down what happens in our bodies when we eat a huge meal.
Once the food actually enters our mouth and we are chewing the food, saliva helps to break down the food. We then swallow the food, and some people will say that swallowing, and it's true, up until defecation is the last voluntary component of digestion.
So once you swallow, there's no going back. The food moves through the esophagus.
Like almost as if someone's squeezing toothpaste out of a tube.
Into the stomach.
The stomach crushes the food and mixes, also secretes acid that helps to break down the food. By the time the food leaves the stomach, it's a paste-like material, and it's passed into the small intestines.
From there, the food breaks down even more. Nutrients are absorbed all along the way until it exits the body. But on Thanksgiving, we eat way more than usual.
Yeah, so the stomach, you know, that muscular bag, it can, on average, hold about a liter. But it can expand. It can stretch up to about 4 liters.
That's bigger than a gallon jug of milk. Imagine that, filled with mashed potatoes and gravy sloshing around inside of you, pressing up against your organs.
We will pay the price in terms of, you know, we will feel uncomfortable. You know, our body has to work harder. And you may feel a little bit tired after your meal or sluggish because your body's then directing a lot of that energy just into trying to break down that meal.
What about sometimes when I've really overdone it in terms of food, my heart is racing. I'm just feeling like, whoa. I'm running, but I'm not. I'm just laying on the couch, you know? Why is your heart beating more?
So that's a part of the body revving up the metabolism. Your gut needs more blood flow, needs more oxygen to supply the gut so that it can absorb and so that the stomach can break down. So your heart has to increase its production to help out the digestive tract.
Why do we overeat so much? It seems like sometimes we keep eating and eating, and then suddenly it's like, oh no, now I've way overdone it. But we don't know it until it's too late.
Our body secretes different hormones that makes us either feel full or makes us hungry. There's a fine balance between those hormones. The hormones that make us hungry, those don't drop to its lowest point until about 30 to 60 minutes after a meal. And the hormones that make us feel full and satisfied, those don't peak until about 30 to 60 minutes after our meal. So it's very easy for us to eat a meal and actually have a full stomach, but not yet feel full.
So does slowing down help?
Definitely. One of the things I'd strongly advise is just taking our time and chewing our food. You know, the longer we're taking to chew and eat our food, you know, we're pacing ourselves. And then, you know, that gives your body time to let you know that it's full. After you finish eating, you know, probably sit around and wait 20 to 30 minutes and just ask yourself, you know, am I still hungry? Rather than just going immediately back for more after you finish.
Earl Campbell III is a gastroenterologist in Atlanta, Georgia. You're listening to a 2020 Thanksgiving. Cranberries naturally ripen between September and November, so it makes sense that they show up on our Thanksgiving table. During harvest, farmers flood their bogs and the berries float to the top. You've probably seen pictures. It looks beautiful, just like a sea of red. This requires clever engineering, but also a very special type of environment and a lot of water. Growers have to walk a careful line between keeping production up and keeping their land healthy. Last year, Steph Yin took a trip to the New Jersey Pine Barrens, where cranberry growing is a multi-generational tradition.
The Pine Barrens are a spread of dense coastal forest in South Jersey, a million acres, stretching over more than a fifth of the state. From sandy, acidic soil, which locals call sugar sand, sprout rare orchids, carnivorous plants, and pygmy pitch pines. Rivers and streams flow with what looks like tea, the water dyed reddish-brown from cedar trees. This is home to a rich agricultural community, too. Commercial cranberry farming started here in the mid-1800s. The farmers bought large tracts of land for cheap, started cultivating the berries that were growing there naturally. They consider themselves stewards of a rare and remarkable ecosystem.
We look at cranberries as part of a larger system around the bogs.
That's Steve Lee, a fifth-generation Pine Barrens cranberry farmer. He says, cranberries grow wild all over here. Canoe down any local river, and you might be able to collect the fruit right off the riverbed.
They belong in wetlands. If you find a cranberry vine growing in the New Jersey Pinelands, by definition, you are in a wetland. And we've learned to live in harmony with the wetlands.
A large part of that has to do with water. It's a popular misconception that cranberry bogs are always underwater. But it's true that water is important, crucial, really, to cranberry farming. It's hard to pick cranberries from vines on the ground. So to make harvest easier, most cranberry growers flood their bogs in the fall. The berries float to the surface, then growers use harvesting machines called egg beaters to knock them off the vine. In the winter, the bogs are flooded again. This time, the water insulates the plants from frost. Underlying the Pine Barrens is a natural aquifer, 17 trillion gallons of bacterially sterile, sand-filtered water that scientists have compared to melted glacial ice.
So we got a floodgate here.
The farmers here divert water from nearby streams and rivers to flood their bogs. It's an interconnected system that allows them to share and cycle water between one another.
We have our neighbors to the north, the Lees, and our neighbors to the south, the Suis. We got to work with them. Like, hey, I'm sending some water your way. Hey, we need some water.
That's Mike Haynes. He and his sister Steph are giving me a tour of their farm.
A new bog. We renovated a couple years.
Mike and Steph are fifth generation growers, and they help run their family business, the Pine Island Cranberry Company. They sell their cranberries through Ocean Spray, which is a private co-op of some 700 cranberry farms. Ocean Spray dominates the U.S. market. The co-op takes berries grown by farmers, markets them, and processes them into products like juice, craisins, or the cranberry sauce you might be having for Thanksgiving. Steph says water is central to their operation.
If we do not have a clean, abundant water supply, then we don't get anywhere.
Their grandfather built the family business accordingly.
He was the one who understood the importance of farming for not him, not for himself, not for his generation, not even for the next generation, but like for my generation. A lot of what we're doing now is built upon what he was doing back in the 40s and 50s.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense what you're saying. When you have a multi-generational family farm, you have to think about sustainability.
Yes.
Because that's literally in your interest.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
To ensure clean water, you need to control a lot of land. In the Pinelands, growers follow this general rule of thumb. For every 1 acre of producing cranberry bog, they maintain 9 acres of supporting woodland to protect the watershed. But cranberry farming can pose a major threat to waterways because of pesticide and fertilizer runoff. Think of the settings cranberries thrive in. Moist, swampy. It's the kind of situation insects, fungi, parasites, and weeds love. The vast majority of farms use a range of synthetic chemicals, which get discharged into local water bodies and can be harmful. The New Jersey farmers say they use fertilizers sparingly.
It's not a hit or miss. It's very calculated.
With pesticides, they do targeted spot treatments. And they're using gentler chemicals than before. Researchers are also trying to figure out how and if ecosystems bounce back after years of cranberry growing. My last stop is to a former bog with Ped Deneshgar, an ecologist at Monmouth University in New Jersey. I'm here with him and other members of his lab, and we're trying to find a trace of what once was.
I'm trying to see if I can find a surviving cranberry.
Do you think there is one?
Well, we found some last time.
Really?
Yeah. You just see them. They're usually really little. They look more like how they...
If you didn't know this was once a thriving cranberry bog, you wouldn't guess it. It feels like a wild ecosystem. We're surrounded by trees, pine, red maple, and lots of Atlantic white cedars, some as tall as 30 or 40 feet. There's a layer of pine needles underfoot. Overhead, blue jays are calling, trying to shoo us from their territory.
Yeah, blue jays are not thrilled with us being
here. Yeah, territorial.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I feel like there is this narrative that cranberry farming is like super environmentally impactful.
Our work does not show that. And I started this with the idea that we were going to find some really scary things.
Instead, Ped was surprised to find that the effects of intensive cranberry agriculture seemed minimal, at least with some time.
I think it's more of a testament of the pinelands just being very resilient.
That story was reported by Steph Yin last year. This is a 2020 Thanksgiving, a special production from The Pulse. We're talking about all of the things we love about this holiday and what will be different this year. Food obviously plays a starring role during Thanksgiving, and it's a time to be grateful for the bounty on our tables. And this year, we may be looking at all that food with fresh eyes.
The pandemic has really been a wake-up call for our food system and the fragility of our food system in the United States. I think we saw how quickly the systems break down.
That's Nate Mook. He is the CEO of World Central Kitchen. It's a nonprofit founded by Chef Jose Andres that feeds people impacted by natural disasters and crises.
Sometimes I like to kind of call us like an air traffic controller, so to speak. So we're connecting the needs with the supply.
Nate says early on in the pandemic, many people saw completely empty shelves in grocery stores for the first time.
We also saw how, on one hand, we had lines at food banks. We couldn't get enough food to families that were struggling and that continue to struggle. But then we were seeing images of farms with so much excess and surplus because restaurants were closed and they couldn't sell their produce and they were plowing it under, or we saw dairies that were dumping milk. So it's this real, you know, disconnect, right? Of like, on one hand, we have excess food that we're wasting. And then on the other hand, we have families that are going hungry every night. So I think this was really a big wake-up call for the work that needs to be done in our country, that we need to invest in our food systems. We need to recognize that we need to improve the way that food flows from our farms and supporting our local farmers all the way to the families.
His organization first got involved in helping out during this pandemic in February. They were delivering meals to people quarantining on a cruise ship off the coast of Japan. At this time, nobody really knew how this was going to unfold. But did you also foresee the big impact on the restaurant industry and on grocery shopping and everything else? I mean, there were so many moving parts.
Yeah, very quickly, we realized that this was going to be the case, that we were going to have restaurants that were going to have to shut down, access to food was going to be difficult, that our seniors were not going to be able to leave their homes, and we're going to need food delivery. So we started to look at how we can best play a role in this. And we're an organization that adapts in real time a lot. You have to after big disasters because you never know what to expect. Our founder, Chef Jose Andres, has a number of restaurants and he closed them very early on. And he said, you know, we're going to start shifting our restaurants over to what we call community kitchens. So the restaurants will continue to produce food and do it safely using the protocols that we developed for Japan. But instead of serving your traditional customer base, we're going to get food out to the community, folks that don't have access. And that was really the beginning of what we called our Restaurants for the People program. And what we did was we, all across the country, we were able to activate restaurants that were otherwise pretty dormant. They weren't able to cook for anybody. They couldn't have customers in, and they were really struggling just to keep paying their rent and stay in business. And we said, well, what if we can put those restaurants back to work for our country?
Nate says with donations, the organization was able to pay restaurants for the cost of the meals they were producing, to keep some staff working, to keep the lights on. You've done quite a bit of work in the startup culture, and I'm wondering if you're seeing anything interesting where people are creating a more direct line from food producer to consumer. For example, you know, in my neighborhood, there is a seafood guy who comes every week now. He used to deliver his seafood to restaurants, and then he completely pivoted, started reaching out to customers directly, and I think he's done amazingly well during this time, and he could have lost his business. So what else are you seeing in terms of solutions and interesting stuff that people are doing because of this crisis?
I think there's a lot of positive progress that's coming out of this. I think folks are recognizing the importance of local production and local resilience in the food systems, that, you know, we can't rely on all of our food being trucked in or shipped in from the outside. And so we're starting to see, I think, some things come to fruition or at least start to bubble up, which is really great. So local providers that are more directly engaging with consumers, so not necessarily having to even go through a middleman, but farms directly providing through CSAs and other programs directly providing to households. I think the other thing you're seeing is the use of technology, which is great. There's really no excuse for us to be dumping food in one part of the country when we have another part of the country that's starving. We can make those connections. And instead of that food being thrown out, that food could be transported. And as long as we can figure out a way to cover the cost of that transport, which is one of the things the federal government can do, we can get that food to a place that needs it so desperately.
This Thanksgiving, Nate says he'll be grateful for all the volunteers who helped get millions of meals to people across the country. And he'll be thinking about the deeper meaning of food.
And recognizing that food needs to be at the center of the conversation, right? Food is not just about the calories that we are consuming, but it's much more symbolic. You know, a hot plate of food during a time of crisis is a message of hope. It's a message that somebody is thinking about you, somebody is caring about you, and that things will get better.
Nate Mook is the CEO of World Central Kitchen. Coming up, remembering the people we lost.
The 1st of November, my mother would go shopping for, you know, she would even go down south and get her black walnuts.
That's next.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.